Welcome to Middlebrow, where big ideas undergo the digital martyrdom. I'm John Mark Reynolds, joined by Paul Spears, and usually by Fred Sanders, but today Fred Sanders is played by
John Granger.
So much better than Fred Sanders.
It really is true. Trinitarian theology compared to Harry Potter were really clear.
Wow, okay, I'm moving away from the lightning strike.
Yeah, I was going to say, the hog pro all pros are all here.
That's
hi, guys.
True. So that's what we're going to talk about today. Harry Potter once again goes through the digital martyrdom. So here's the tough thing. You get up to talk about the Harry Potter books. I take Harry Potter books pretty seriously. I'll have something to say about them. I'll give a comparison. And somebody gets up in the back of the room and says, that's the stupidest thing
I've ever heard.
You have a PhD in philosophy. We want to hear something serious.
That's why you don't know anything.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So I'm actually going to ask Paul Spears this question too. So Paul, be prepared. But John, you're the expert. The Harry Potter books. Let's say the greatest fantasy series ever written is Lord of the Rings, because it's almost created a genre.
Even nobody reads it anymore.
Yeah. Okay, that hurts.
Nobody.
That hurts my soul.
My family reads it.
The Harry Potter books, they're better than Lord of the Rings. They're equal to, they're worse than. Are they great?
Well, James Thomas is a professor of English literature at Pepperdine. He says they're better than Narnia and the Lord of the Rings.
Okay.
And I'm not going to speak for James. I can tell you why I think that you can make that case. You can make that case because Rowling is exploring all the great themes. You know, it's war and peace. It's love and death. It's
right.
It's redemption, salvation. It's what the human being is and what our end is, how we get there, what justifies the means. It's a remarkable text. It operates on all the four levels. You know, you've got a literal meaning. You've got a moral meaning. You've got an allegorical meaning. You've got the mythic, anagogical thing. It's all there. But it's accessible and it's comic. Rowling, by choice or by inability, never can rise to a magisterial height in her prose. We don't get
like a Tolkien-like moment.
Right. We don't get a Tolkien moment. We don't even get Lewis moments. When she tries, two things that Rowling doesn't do well. She doesn't do romance scenes well.
Right. I mean, really, so you're anticipating my criticism.
Well, no.
Yeah.
I mean, if you read Rowling, you know, you got teenagers snogging. Okay. To me, that's I'm reading this closely only because this is what I do for a living.
Those are pages you could skip.
This is right. I mean, those pages don't get turned over other than, here we go. Those scenes, you pass them by, they engage her reader, they're groundling fare. But
right.
with, she has so engaged. And I think all of us as 20th and 21st century readers have to understand that we are groundlings,
right.
That we're no longer the Shakespearean audience in the box. We are the people on the dirt, on the floor of the stage.
Well, let me push back for a second. And I want to say, before I push back, I bought 4 copies of the last book because we like the book so well in our house.
You mean you didn't want the fight to happen?
Yeah, there was
no. It's my turn. No.
Exactly.
I got 3 copies. One of my children bought a 4.
Yeah, that's right. My son actually, I think, bought his own copy, and then I paid him back because I thought, oh my gosh, you try to get kids to read, and I'm making him pay for a book. This is insane. Make him pay for the next Wii game he gets,
but
not his own copy of a book. So obviously, I like these books a lot. But let me say, here are 2 criticisms, and I want your feedback, and pretty much we're going to let you win these arguments because you know more about it than we do.
And he's visiting,
but he knows more about it than we do. In a Plato fight, I'll defend anything. But one, it really counts against her. Let me say something about Tolkien. Tolkien writes some bad purple prose, but he also writes some awesomely beautiful prose. And I won't even try to distinguish which is which for you. But in the Narnia books, some of which are thinly plotted, Prince Caspian's not my all-time favorite book. I actually preferred the film. I'm the only one in America to the book.
Who will admit it?
Who will admit it? But any of the Narnia books contain paragraphs that almost any writer would wish that he or she had written. Whereas I can't find a single paragraph anywhere in Harry Potter that I think I couldn't have written that paragraph. Now, I couldn't have written the books. And so what I'm saying to you is I think they're near great. I just told you how awesome I think they were. But surely it counts. Greatness is a big category. It's hard to get into that. And surely it counts that you can't write a paragraph that makes the angels weep. She's better in the big picture than she is. The devil's in the details.
Okay. Again, here we are in literature. There's nothing sublime in Harry Potter.
Right.
That's your point.
Not even a paragraph of sublimity.
Okay. I that's a point.
And there is in Prince Caspian, which is a worse book, I will say, than any of the Harry Potter books as a book.
Agreed. Now, the absence of the sublime to you is an exclusion to greatness.
The good, the true, and the beautiful.
Could we do the Coleridge moment of what sublime is since we're batting it about?
Give us a definition of the sublime.
Well,
I'm just over here playing the not smart listener on the radio. Or on the
there's so many of those who are podcasts.
It's a moment where what appears to you is a transparency to something much greater than itself.
Right.
A window through which one could see more greatness or...
That's right. And in Rowling, the sublimity is in her symbols and in the depth of the experience that you have inside the text.
Yeah, I'll buy that.
That we're meant to identify with Harry Potter's adventure. And she does this... first of all, with her narratological voice. I mean, she chooses third-person limited omniscience, so the reader is posted something like a house elf sitting on Harry's shoulder with a minicam. And the minicam...
I'm doing the whole vision of the house elf with the minicam.
Well, he's sitting...
And then when they get in trouble, they're hitting themselves with the minicam.
Well, it's easy for him to do that because he's sitting next to a house elf, right? John... Anyway,
he's comparing himself to a house elf. For those of you who can't see this.
Oh, well, anybody who's met me knows that every year I become more and more like Dobby. This is scary. Anyway, this perspective that she chooses has the reader hovering over Harry's head, imagining that he or she has an objective view of what's going on. When, of course, all they're doing, just like Austin's Emma, we're rolling lifts this wholesale,
right,
is experiencing Harry's world and more identifying with Harry. So the whole book is about Harry as a symbol of the spiritual aspect of the soul and his purification, where he becomes the philosopher's stone. He becomes, you know, the seeing eye under the invisibility cloak. And in that purification, where all he begins to see the front and back of people, especially when he chooses to believe in the grave on Easter morning, in Dobby's grave or whatever, when he chooses to believe there, and he drops the external Harry Potter self, and he becomes the all-seeing eye, you know, the heir of the Potter, as it were, as his name suggests. The reader has so identified with that and has experienced already with Harry all of his different faux deaths and resurrections in the presence of a symbol of Christ, the previous six books,
right,
that when this moment comes where he is a symbol of Christ, the majesty of that moment in the identification is its sublimity, which is not in the prose text, the words itself.
Yeah, and isn't that a problem? This is what I'm saying to you, John. If we're having a discussion about whether Rowling is a great writer, the answer is yes. But great writer. We're putting her in.
The target is moving here.
No. We're putting her in this tiny little category of people who forever changed children's literature cross generations. So I am right now reading Alice in Wonderland and enjoying it.
Ariana Dumbledore is Alice Liddell.
Okay. I'm not sure that, what are we from Alice in Wonderland? 120 years, round number. I'm not sure in 120 years it's not going to be so dated. I've run into very little in Alice in Wonderland that tells me that it was written by an Oxfordian, you know, in the period that it was written in.
Well, and frankly, nobody reads it.
Well, can I?
Okay, that's probably fair, right? There aren't a whole bunch of people sitting around reading Alice in Wonderland, including children, is what you're saying.
For example, there are things in Harry Potter you're never going to find in Tolkien. There are Uranus jokes. I mean, we're not looking for... I mean, there's comedy in The Lord of the Rings.
Right, but they're not afraid to go a little juvenile.
That's right.
Doesn't that get dated more quickly than almost anything else? It's hard to imagine Lord of the Rings getting dated, right? It's because it's already
mythic.
Archaic.
It's mythic, right.
Well, isn't it also, though, that one of the things...
Paul Spears.
That we notice in the... in something called a great book, is that it's a continuation of a great conversation that then it pushes someone else to continue the great conversation. And so especially if you think about sort of the Western canon of great books, what you're thinking is an ongoing question, like, what does it mean to be human? And then you start with somebody like Homer, who just lays the genre out. and then you move forward. So she's not laying out a new genre, really. She's using all the old ones and using them well, but she's not actually creating something, nor I'm not even convinced that she's moving the conversation forward. She's taking the conversation, recapitulating it, doing some really good work with it. But is she something that later writers are going to look back on as a stepping stone to continue this great conversation? Yeah,
and I would say almost certainly she is. I mean, when Rowling,
we won't live to know, so we can all say whatever we want. Because I would say that I would
and those
say
of you
that,
laughing out there in the 22nd century.
I would say that Don Treader, for example. So we picked on Lewis's weakest children's book, in my opinion. But Don Treader is a pretty perfect plot. You can read it without knowing much of anything. There's great character development in someone like Eustace, and there are passages of Don Treader that
the dragon.
Yeah,
when he becomes a dragon,
they sail into
the cortical
or whatever.
I mean, when the cortical goes into the
And it's beautifully written.
Oh yeah.
And what I'm going to
makes
say
makes me weep.
So
literally.
I wonder if there's any single, and notice how short it is, because the other criticism, and then you get total punchback time, is that the last four books, when nobody could tell her what to do anymore, because she was obviously the goddess of publishing, children's publishing.
400 million books will do that.
Yeah. Come on. She needed to edit them. They're too long.
Yeah, how long
never
were we
reading,
going to be in the
no
woods?
No fan ever reads Lord of the Rings.
Well,
and
the
says,
the woods are necessary. I'll argue on that one. But
I've never met a Lord of the Rings fan who said the book is padded. If anything, as Tolkien points out.
I heard that last night on the Biola campus.
Okay. There you go.
Okay.
Is this Lord of the Rings is padded. It's too long.
I heard it. Now.
So I stand corrected.
Well, I don't agree. But I've heard people say, I've heard many young people say they can't read Tolkien, that it's an incredibly boring.
Well, that's an indictment of our culture, not
vocabulary.
An indictment of Tolkien.
Let's face it, the
but
vocabulary
this
is difficult.
This is my point: is that Rowling advances the conversation in terms of meaning tremendously in terms of Harry Potter as the perfected soul. I mean, just the things that she steals in wheelbarrows are incredible inside these things.
Does the book need to be edited? That's my simple question to you. Does six need every single chapter that's there?
Yes.
And six is, by the way, for the rest of us, again, in the audience.
Half-Blood Prince. Better to have chosen five.
In my opinion, five is the worst book in the series. Six is marginally better, and seven is pretty close to perfect, though Hermione's bag is one of the worst literary devices, I think,
But it's actually critical because the inside has to be bigger than the outside.
Yes, but I wish that I knew that Hermione put everything in it that arbitrarily gets withdrawn from it. It starts to feel like...
Well, it's like, well, the Room of Requirement and King's Cross and the bag are all the same picture.
I said I'd let you have a big, long rant. So take a big, long rant defending... So they're my two criticisms. As compared to Don Treader... Look, of course, everything you're saying about these books is true.
Let's go to Don Treader because it's a wonderful contrast with what Rowling is saying about art and your experience of literature and what Lewis says.
Yes, go, rant away.
Lewis begins The Voyage of the Don Treader with a neglected painting in a spare bedroom that has a Narnian ship in it that Edmund and Lucy are longing for. Eustace comes in, of course, and starts talking about what a lousy painting it is when the painting expands and takes over the room. Now, you'd think the Narnians would dive in to get onto the ship, but the Narnians, King Edmund and Queen Lucy, fight the artwork, and it sucks them in. This is the Ruskin Lewis position on artwork, that you're engaged by it. It will engage your imagination, and its vision will so color your world that this experience is transformative.
It's irresistible.
Right, that the artistic vision is transformative. Rowling's position, really much more of a postmodern one, and a subversive one, is that art is an exchange. That when you walk out to a painting in Hogwarts, you need to know the magic word to get to the inside, which is bigger than the outside. Not all paintings allow you to get behind them, but some of them do. You need to know where to touch them. You need to know how to speak to them. They're almost like hippogriffs, where you have to approach them in the right manner of respect and have an exchange, or they're going to bite you, or they're just going to ignore you. You're not going to have this meaningful exchange. Ariana is obviously the most important painting in the entire series, in that They have no idea she's a passageway.
Right.
Until Harry breaks through Aberforth Dumbledore and breaks him in terms of, are you going to help us or not? We're here to save the world, and I know that I'm going to die for this if I have to. Aberforth then calls his sister, and she walks, Alice Liddell that she is, she walks pretty much through the looking glass to the Room of Requirement and to the Land of Imagination, the Coleridge's active imagination or whatever, and primary imagination, and brings them back from the Room of Requirement.
Yeah, this definitely is not Ruskin, and I think is an improvement in many ways for a Christian, as a Christian living in the 21st century anyway, on Ruskin, since we're not Victorians. So go ahead.
So this artistic experience that Rowling is describing is one of engagement, that you approach this work and then you'll find the inside, which is bigger than the outside. Now, this is the theme, which is all it's a pointer to the last battle, where King Tyrion comes into the stable by force and finds himself in Aslan's country.
Right.
And he says, hey, how can the stable on the inside be a different place than the one on the outside? And King Diggory says, its inside is bigger than its outside. And Lucy, in a state of wonderment, almost of ecstasy, says, it's like in our world, there was a stable that had something bigger than our entire world.
Right.
That the inside bigger than the outside is the Logos. You know,
right.
Obviously the stable in Bethlehem being Jesus of Nazareth, who is the Word incarnate. But in these texts, it's that aspect of the human person. It's the kingdom of heaven within. It's the Logos mind, which is the identity, hence all the I symbolism. Rowling is taking you there because Harry Potter, the key passage you talked about in our last conversation, where he says, is this real or just in my head? And Dumbledore says, it's in your head, but why would you think it's not real? Because that real place is this noetic thing of which you are the image.
Well, and of course, any Tory student who's listening to this or graduate knows that I struggle with, are fictional characters real? I think probably in some sense, fictional characters are real. And and knowing that, so I'm with you. But my complaint is execution. The reason they're near great is just what you're saying. The reason they're not near great was Quidditch, to the extent that it's mentioned in the last four books, necessary, or is it there because the fans demanded it and Scholastic demanded it? And
the movies
demanded it, and it's padding of the sort that you don't get in Dawn Treader.
Well, maybe, but of course, all of the Narnia Chronicles are in different times.
Right.
So you don't see this kind of fatigue, story fatigue. Rowling, several of her devices jump the shark, where Polyjuice Potion is an essential part of the book in which it first appears, where Hermione has to find out who the heir of Slytherin is. And
but
she
then it's hard to control it, right? You should always use it.
Here's the story element that appears everywhere. I mean, Horace Slughorn finds out he's going to be the potions master. In the last weeks of the summer, he arrives at school in this potion, which takes months and months to brew. He's got a giant pot of it when he arrives. You're like, well, wait a minute. Where did this stuff come from?
Well, isn't that the same problem? Like, what do you do with Superman when he's all powerful?
Well,
it's that kind of
question.
This is where
I blame her for this, because Gene Roddenberry did the same thing with the transporter in Star Trek. He needed it to solve the problem that he couldn't have the shuttlecraft go down to a planet every week because he couldn't afford it. But once he had invented the transporter, it's all powerful. He should be able to create anything with the transporter. So it always has to be broken so that Kirk can be in actual danger. It becomes more and more bizarre, right? What to do with the transporter. Can't we blame Roddenberry for that? And can't we blame Rowling for that? She shouldn't have introduced a transporter into the Harry Potter.
That would be like blaming Liddell because, the rabbit holes, you can't keep finding rabbit holes, or the mirror doesn't keep working, or she can't, what does he induce these dreams for her to have these adventures or whatever?
Fair enough.
When you're talking about fantasy stories, you're going to have tropes and things that in a series which is 4,100 pages long, and she introduces them in the first 200 or first 900. By the time you get to 4,100, you're like, oh, here we go.
But that's not bad. But that's just to say that it's not internally consistent, and that's okay.
No,
but that's,
I don't.
Is that where you push back, though, on
the greatness? Yeah, but this is where I push back. I think she knew she was going to write seven books if somebody would let her. And she had, allegedly, this is all one work of art, isn't it? Books 1 through 7. So she knew that she had created a spell that was too powerful, or she should have known. You can't introduce the quote-unquote all-powerful transformative spell and not have... Why don't they use it all the time?
No, that's... I was agreeing with you, John.
Yeah, exactly, Paul, I know.
The spell that gets out of control is the Fidelius Charm.
Tell us about that, if somebody doesn't know the books really well.
The Fidelius Charm is a spell that involves placing a secret within the mesh of a soul of a wizard or witch or a wizard.
Yeah, this is lovely.
And he's the secret keeper. Now, you can imagine the magic involved with this little trick. Now, I thought, mistakenly, I was corrected by Felicity and others on my website, I thought that Dumbledore was the only one who could pull this off, and it was a very limited usage. Well, not really.
It would have been better if that had been true, by the way. Let me hasten to say.
Spock does this in what, Star Trek II?
Yeah, that's right. Well, no, once you start, if you limit it, that's why I'm saying she could have gotten out of this by limiting it and saying this is so insanely difficult. Three wizards in history can do this.
Right.
But instead, even Dumbledore doesn't even place the secret keeping charm on Peter Pettigrew, or he would have known that Peter Pettigrew was the secret keeper. That's a big part of the books that nobody knows that. In fact, James Potter or Sirius Black or Lily Potter is the one who conjures the Fidelius Charm and binds Peter Pettigrew with it.
The Patronus Charm, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, remember I only read these books, it's Patronus.
Right.
It seems to get easier as the books go along too, right?
Well, in book seven, Harry's unable to do it in the presence of his thing, and his friends have to come out and assist him. His teaching ability saves him at the last minute.
Originally you get the impression that you have to be insanely competent to do it, and in the end, lots of people can do it.
Harry trains them to do it in Dumbledore's army.
Right.
And many of them still struggle with it. Hermione is the weakest. Hermione has never been a good Patronus. She never really gets the hang of it.
But don't you feel like that got a little easier from one book to another?
It's only that Harry has to do it when he's a third-year student, and he shouldn't have anywhere near the capability to do that. And he also does a fully corporeal Patronus, which is somewhat different than what most Patronuses look like, apparently.
Right.
His is apparently an astonishing...
But go ahead with the other charm. What's the big mess with it?
The Fidelius Charm gets complicated because... Rowling was told she had a contest about what questions you want me to answer. And they said, detail the Fidelius Charm for us. And she said, well, that wasn't the one I would have chosen. Well, the reason the fans wanted to know about it was it just seems bizarre.
Right.
The rules of this charm are that, and I may have it wrong. This is the kind of detail that I'm miserable
at. Yeah, somebody's going to write us a really angry letter.
This is not what I bring to the Harry Potter table.
John Mark Reynolds at Biola.
Paul.
You should write.
Yeah, and I'll forward it to Paul Spears.
No.
John Granger gets us hate mail from fandom.
Fandom laughs at me all the time because whenever I give a talk, I eventually I'll say Voldemort when I see Dumbledore or the other way.
Oh, sure.
This is not what I bring to the table, the mastery of detail or whatever. But the Fidelius Charm.
By the way, I must say the people listening. A lot of people get confused about that. 2 + 2 = 4 is not how you become a great mathematician. And a lot of our students will come in and memorize every character in the Iliad. And actually, because they read it the day before, know it better than I do in that sense. But they can't say anything about the book. And so if anybody has this confusion.
Language doesn't equal understanding.
Right. Let me mock you. let me mock you. But go ahead.
The secret keeper is the only person who's able to communicate the secret, which is enmeshed inside their soul. And Rowling has said if, for example, Voldemort pressed his nose up against the glass of Lily and James Potter's house, he wouldn't have been able to see them there because this secret is that powerful that it keeps them protected. Well, it doesn't seem to work that way. I mean, for example, when Harry side along apparated, whatever Dobby does with his magic from the Malfoy Manor battle, he appears next to Shell Cottage. Well, Shell Cottage is protected by Bill Weasley, the secret keeper. Harry shouldn't be able to see the cottage.
Right.
Well, he doesn't have to press his nose up against the window. It's right off there in the distance, and he yells to them for help. I mean, that's only one piece of the problem with that.
Right.
I mean, for example, they say that after Dumbledore dies, no one else should be able to learn the secret, and no one else should be able to pass on the secret because they're not the secret keeper. But the order says they can't move back into 12 Grimmauld Place because someone of the order may tell someone else. Well, if the secret keeper died and everything stays the way it was, they shouldn't be able to.
But see, this is the precisely... Now, look, there are Narnian anomalies. Nobody writes a great book or even a decent book.
A 4,100-page book.
Right, yeah, that doesn't contain anomalies. But my problem with the Harry Potter books right from the beginning, when my kids asked, could we read the Harry Potter books, I said, well, you can if you want, but, you know... My problem with them from the beginning is magic was too powerful and it could solve too many problems. And you kept wondering why the competent wizards didn't solve more problems using magic than they in fact did.
This is a great point, because this goes back to Paul's point about advancing the, you know, the story and the conversation. Rowling exists in a world where our state religion is naturalism and materialism.
That's a very good point.
Where all things are matter and energy. So who cares if it's illogical, because you're asserting that as a truth and truth has no matter or energy in it.
Yes.
Outside of the contradictions of that, everything that we learn in our schools, our media, our government, that's our state religion. That's our point of position. Rowling takes the position that there's a reality inside the world, beneath it, behind it, or whatever, which is much greater and which is magical. And she ties it specifically to this logos theology, the word created. All the wand cores have connections to Christ symbolically.
Right.
Okay. And Harry is this aspect of the human person who is the logos, the uncreated part of the soul. And it's the whole story is about his perfection. Advance the conversation. I'll say she is. She's taking materialism, naturalism on straight on in story and engaging the imaginations of a generation. Here's the shared text of at least really three generations, 400 million books. We're talking about people that have from their 50s on downs know what a muggle is if they're alive inside the United States or the world today.
And they read books.
And they read books.
Because isn't the punchback that more people saw the film than the book?
Certainly. The point about the movies as shared text is that it can only really communicate, for example, that we talked about the narratological drive in the person. You can't do that in the movie. You'd be insane. You'd be mad just following Harry around. You'd never see his face. You know?
That's excellent. So
you don't have the same experience. All you have is the literal meaning, maybe because the literal meaning and the moral meaning usually cross. But you're not going to get the allegorical meaning. You're certainly not going to get the power of the symbolism, the anagogical stuff.
So you would make the argument, I'm trying to summarize, and the pushback's been excellent. You would make the argument that perhaps the Harry Potter books are the greatest children's books ever written.
Easily. And
that they easily are, or that perhaps they are, or that easily perhaps they are. We have very discriminating listeners.
I would say that they definitely are the most important children's books ever written. And I wouldn't call them children's books. These are books just
And I don't mean that as an insult.
What does Lewis say about children's books?
That's right. Lewis wrote books that he wanted to write because that genre suited what he was trying to say, and Rowling for the same.
And good books should be reread even as children, as adults, and you should get, you know, much joy out of them.
But I feel
Back of the North Wind would be a perfect example of that.
I feel pretty persuaded in one way by you, John, because I'll say something that I wouldn't have to say if I just wanted to win an argument, which I never just want to do. And that is Potter books are the only books that we've mentioned that every single member of my family will have read by the end of this year. Because my wife, who is no fan of fantasy and has read, I think, not all the Narnia books and will never read Lord of the Rings under any circumstance. She's 44 years old, has read all of the Harry Potter books and read them quickly. And for her, given homeschooling four kids and all that she has to do, that was an enormous giving of her time. This is my Jane Austen, very biography. It's the only fantasy book she's ever read. Probably with enjoyment, where she didn't have to.
Well, this Touchstone is publishing an article I wrote in this November issue about Harry Potter as shared text, and the story I tell in that is my first day at the University of Chicago. Alan Bloom gives the Aims of Education address and comes back to our college house to rip us into shreds.
So we're all bitter.
I heard him tell Paul Wheatley, who was the head of our college house, he was the chairman of the Committee on Social Thought.
Right.
He says, Paul, any Chicago graduate can do an impersonation of Bloom at the drop of a hat. You know, Paul, these monkeys. What do I have in common with these baboons? And he walks.
That's when you drop out of college.
And I walked in there thinking, well, who is this? You know, I won't say the word I wanted to
say.
I go in there, and
who
is this pompous, you know, person? And I sit down in the marvelous common room at Chicago's Hitchcock Hall or whatever, and
Another moment of envy by everyone in the audience.
Well, Trace, I'm fascinated by the girl from Guam. Forget Alan Bloom.
Okay. You were typical.
And Bloom stands up and says, look, your grandparents, great-grandparents, all had a semi-memorized knowledge of the Bible, Pilgrim's Progress, and Plutarch's Lives of the Noble Greeks and Romans.
Yes.
They didn't know many other books very well. Maybe they knew some Dickens.
Right.
He said, but they knew those three books backwards and forwards, and it filled all public conversation because these shared texts and what a name. Mm-hmm. You said Nimrod, and people knew the exact biblical reference and context of what the person was saying.
Sure, that's my 8th grade graduate grandfather could have told you who Nimrod was. Absolutely.
That, he says, I walk into this room with some of the best and brightest minds of the world. Incoming class at the University of Chicago.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's absolutely true.
And I know that none of you have a shared text. I know that few of you have read the Bible through, and that none of you could talk intelligently about it. And all of us look at each other like, who is this guy? And he says, have any of you read Pilgrim's Progress or Plutarch's Lives?
Isn't that what he does in Closing of the American Mind? Isn't that the attack that he makes in the
You better believe
chapter?
It. I experienced that chapter. He says you cannot talk.
I'm sure it was a little different.
John Granger speaks the word, man. This is a straight word here.
Well, I mean, he comes in and he basically says, he confronts us on relativism. He says, to you, relativism is a dogma. He says, and if I say that relativism is nonsense and self-contradictory, you see me as a witch hunter.
Right.
And we all went, yes, you are a witch hunter. You must be. You must be a royalist or something, something like that. And he just laughed at us and told us that we had come to the right place and that we were about to be fire hosed with the great books, and that we would, with our help, our participation in our correction, that Chicago would fix us. It gave us a shared text. What it does in terms of truth, goodness, and virtue.
Yeah, there's
beauty,
another problem.
Beauty in another world entirely.
As many of his students could report. Sadly. And I'm not being critical.
But right now,
I
went into
another.
The Regenstein Library basement that week, and all of the geeks were there in my class said, okay, what's our shared text? We must have a book in common. And I thought, okay, Lord of the Flies. About half, like 15 of us there. Half of us had read that. Romeo and Juliet, even less. Tale of Two Cities, we're dropping. We're dropping here, whatever.
Right.
The Bible, about two or three of us had read the whole book. And I'm going thinking, what do we have in common? Some of these people were math geeks. Some of these people, early computer geeks, the mainframe guys or whatever. This was late 70s, early 80s. What did this generation have in common? We go to comic books. We haven't even got comic books in common. What we finally came up with as our shared text, Batman television serials.
Well, yeah.
That was it.
I would have gone to Monty Python and wondered how that would have gone.
Maybe. All I remember was, but a lot
but
of
that
these,
was
a lot
what
of,
it was.
A lot of these kids were from the Midwest and
oh,
didn't
see,
even have access.
No,
to
that's right. PBS was not yet showing
that's
it
right.
at that
so
point. Yeah.
We had Batman television serials in common. We named, I think, something like 30 of the 36 villains. We're laughing hysterically that we knew all these villains, and the six
yeah,
we didn't know were one-offs
fair
or whatever.
Fair play to you.
That. My generation, as a shared text, wow. had camp parody of a comic book on a television screen broken by mercantile interruptions periodically for, Alka-Seltzer or whatever. That was the depth of our shared text.
Whereas
this
you're...
generation, if I talk to them about the eye symbolism of Harry Potter, they all move forward on their seats because
right.
they've been to the place I'm describing. It's not so much a book they've read as an experience that they've shared.
So if you're a smart kid who reads books, you've read Harry Potter, unless you came from a particularly...
You've read Harry Potter twice or three
yeah,
times.
Yeah, religious family, you've read Harry Potter. All of the experience
once.
In my house.
exactly.
Yeah.
But isn't it also the case that I'm wondering, so we're deconstructing, I don't mean that pejoratively, the text, and we're starting to say, here are some of the things that are going on inside of the text, and we're actually looking back on our experience, yours through the University of Chicago, and Bloom pounding you mercilessly until you sort of sat upright and actually understood where the grounding is. My concern is that can our students or the people of today that are reading it actually get at it at the level that we're talking about? In other words, is it just like a comic book to them? You know what I mean? To get deconstruct it at the right.
It's a great question because it shows how little we think of the imagination. Where Barfield and Lewis, I'm going to talk about this tonight
right.
here at Torrey, is that Barfield's biggest influence on Lewis was to let him know that the universe was mental, that the universe had the logos as its fabric, its stuff and substance beneath the surface.
Sure.
And the imagination, both of them felt, Lewis described himself repetitively as the imaginative man, that he didn't see himself as an intellectual. He sometimes called himself a rationalist, but that's only in a Coleridgean sense, not in a terms of a logical positivist or something like that, a discursive reason.
Right.
He's talking about the imagination as your means to the fabric of reality and an experience of it, looking along it rather than at it.
Sure.
And so the imaginative work, so much as it's your point of passage to what the logos is, which is what, you know, our responsibility as human beings is to become conscious incarnations of that word. When we experience that imaginatively and we suspend our disbelief, we become less that surface ego persona and more the I, what Lewis calls the sacred I, in their imagination.
But isn't it the case that sometimes you're reading through something like even like Voyage of the Dawn Trader or Harry Potter, and what it becomes is evocative, and that's it. In other words, it raises up an emotional response to you that is only erotic, and is not rational, and is so. In other words, you're reading it and you're going, yes, I see that
in
as
this context, non-sexual erotic.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
That is the fleshly desires. So
yeah.
For those who don't sit around and think about Greek
sorry,
thought
that was,
all the time.
That was my inside baseball moment. Sorry about that.
We don't need you to think about sex here.
And well, there's no erotic in Harry Potter, so it's not like I'm trying to do it that way.
Eating good food is an erotic pleasure.
Yeah, so in other words, what it does is there's an emotional draw to it, but am I able to then take it to a place that I can construct an understanding of it that enables me to pursue the good?
Not the author's responsibility. The author's responsibility is much like the parable of the sower. The parable of the sower, the sower does not prepare the ground. The sower simply casts the seed. Each person reading Harry Potter will be at a different place. Some people respond to it with slash fan fiction. That's not, I think, the intention of the work.
Right.
But that can't be blamed on the author. That's the seed being cast into unprepared ground that's unfit for it.
But I want to get really clear on this. You're telling our listeners, and you're a serious person, I take what you have to say seriously, that 100 years from now, Harry Potter will be conceived of widely as better than Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland.
Absolutely. I have no doubt.
That is more fun than we should be allowed to have today. And unfortunately, that means we've come to an end of putting a big idea through the digital martyrdom. For Middlebrow, this has been John Mark Reynolds with our resident friend of Tory, Harry Potter expert, who thinks that Alice in Wonderland has been superseded, John Granger and Paul Spears. We look forward to your joining us for the next Middlebrow, where we'll put another big idea, maybe John Granger, through the digital martyrdom. Thanks for listening.